Good morning, and welcome to Overeaters Anonymous, a Vision for You Big Book Study. My name is Mo H., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from Northern California. And today is Tuesday, October 16th, and this is the 10 a.m. Eastern Time meeting. Today we are reading from the Big Book, and we are on page 139, starting with the second paragraph. If you desire to help, through five paragraphs ending with the aberrations of the alcoholic. And the comments will be on all five paragraphs. Today's readers are the 12 Steps, Laura A., the 12 Traditions, Nan K., and the readers of the text are Eileen M. and Sherry K. B. And the share ID for Monday, October 15th, 10 a.m. Eastern Time meeting is 12,044. That's 12044. And for today's October 16th, 7 a.m. meeting is 12,047, 12047. And our newcomer greeter today at the end of the meeting is Melanie C. OA Preamble. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. We welcome everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, neither soliciting nor accepting outside donations. OA is not affiliated with any public or private organization, political movement, ideology, or religious doctrine. We take no position on outside issues. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors, and to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of OA to those who still suffer. Our sole purpose, OA's fifth tradition states, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. At A Vision for You Big Book Study, our message is that people who suffer from compulsive overeating can recover through abstinence and the practice of the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous. And I will now ask Laura A. to read the 12 steps.
Hi, this is Laura A., grateful recovered compulsive overeater in New Hampshire. The 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks for letting me do service. I pass.
Thank you, Laura A., and I'll now ask Nan K. to read the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Nan K., a recovered compulsive overeater from Michigan. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. 6, an OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, Every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, television, and other public media of communication. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you and pass.
Thank you, Nan K. How our meeting works. Our meeting focuses on the directions for recovery described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We read a paragraph or two from the literature, then stop and share on what was read. Anyone can share, but we ask that you keep your sharing to the topic and literature we are discussing, and that you keep your share to approximately 3 minutes. Singleness of purpose reminds us to identify as compulsive overeaters only. Our abstinence requirement for moderators is 1 year, and for readers is 6 months. There is no abstinence requirement for sharing on topic. This meeting does request that your sharing be directly linked to what was read. We are sharing what the directions in the Big Book mean to us. To share, press star 1 to unmute. Once you are done sharing, let us know by saying pass, then press star 1 to mute your phone. In order to have a quiet meeting, everyone's phone, except the speaker, should be muted. And today we resume our study of the Big Book, and we are on page 139, the chapter 2, Employers, starting with the second paragraph. If you desire to help, through 5 paragraphs ending with the aberrations of the alcoholic. And I will now ask Eileen M. to get us started. Good morning, Eileen.
Good morning, Mo. This is Eileen M., gratefully recovered in New Hampshire. If you desire to help, it might be well to disregard your own drinking or lack of it. Whether you are a hard drinker, a moderate drinker, or a teetotaler, you may have some pretty strong opinions, perhaps prejudices. Those who drink moderately may be more annoyed with an alcoholic than a total abstainer would be. Drinking occasionally and understanding your own reactions, it is possible for you to become quite sure of many things, which so far as the alcoholic is concerned, are not always so. As a moderate drinker, you can take your liquor or leave it alone. Whether you want to, you control your drinking. Of an evening, you can go on a mild bender, get up in the morning, shake your head, and go to business. To you, liquor is no real problem. You cannot see why it should be to anyone else, save the spineless and stupid. When dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that a man could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Even when you understand the malady better, you may feel this feeling rising. A look at the alcoholic in your organization is many times illuminating. Is he not usually brilliant, fast-thinking, imaginative, and likable? When sober, does he not work hard and have a knack of getting things done? If he has had these qualities and did not drink, would he be worth retaining? Should he have the same consideration as other ailing employees? Is he worth salvaging? If your decision is yes, whether the reason be humanitarian or business or both, then the following suggestions may be helpful. Can you disregard the feeling that you are dealing only with habit, with stubbornness, or a weak will? If this presents difficulty, rereading chapters 2 and 3, where the alcoholic sickness is discussed at length, might be worthwhile. You, as a businessman, want to know the necessities before considering the result. If you concede that your employee is ill, can he be forgiven for what he has done in the past? Can his past absurdities be forgotten? Can it be appreciated that he has been a victim of crooked thinking, directly caused by the action of alcohol on his brain? I well remember the shock I received when a prominent doctor in Chicago told me of cases where pressure of the spinal fluid actually ruptured the brain. No wonder an alcoholic is strangely irrational. Who wouldn't be with such a fevered brain? Normal thinkers are not so affected, nor can they understand the aberrations of the alcoholic. So I am Eileen M., and as I was reading this earlier this morning, I was reminded of one particular incident at an employer that I worked for where, you know, we would always have food in the kitchen and, you know, people would leave things there. They'd leave unopened bags of various things in there. And it was a very small company and there's only 8 people there. And I remember one person that I started eating her pretzels and I kept going back into the kitchen and getting more. And finally, you know, I finished the bag and then I hid the bag so no one, you know, she wouldn't see it. And, you know, she found out that I had eaten them. I don't know how she found that out. But I remember I had such shame about it. And this is just one of many times I had done this at other jobs. And, you know, what happened was I had destroyed potential relationships with these coworkers that I had. And, you know, I was consumed by fear that you know, she was going to go and tell other people that I had done this. And, you know, I'm just, the sentence that's really jumping out at me this morning is the last one that I read, which is, normal drinkers are not so affected, nor can they understand the aberrations of the alcoholic. So, you know, she was a normal, you know, she appeared to be a normal eater to me. And, you know, I could never understand how people could just leave these bags of unopened things in the kitchen, you know, for days and they would be, you know, untouched. So anyway, you know, I returned to my work and, you know, I was not only, you know, I was distracted by the physical craving for more, but I was also distracted by the fear. I had this just consuming fear of people finding out, you know, that fear of being found out. And, you know, I would just remember that as being so awful because, you know, I wanted to have good relationships, but yet I had no control over my actions with food. So I got the ball rolling in these cases and, you know, I didn't really have many friends at work. And anyway, so I wanted to share, that's what came up for me. So thank you so much and I pass.
And thank you, Eileen M., for getting us started. I want to remind everybody that we are on page 135, to employers. Starting with the second paragraph, if you desire to help through 5 paragraphs ending with the aberrations of the alcoholic, comments will be on all 5 paragraphs, and I will now ask for names of those who'd like to share today.
Kathleen O.,
Laura
Julie
A.
H.
Laura, what was your last initial?
A.
Laura A.
Laura A.
Oh, gotcha,
yep.
Laura. And who was yep. Who was after you, Laura?
Julie H.
Okay, Julie H.
Robin P.
Robin P.
Lynn S.
Lynn S.
Suzanne B.
Suzanne B. One more.
Jordan L.
Jordan L. Got you all. Thank you. I'll stop there. I have Kathleen O., Laura A., Julie H., Robin P., Lynn S., Suzanne B., and Jordan L. Kathleen O., will you get us started?
Good morning. Thank you, Mo. Thank you for moderating this morning. This is Kathleen O., recovered compulsive overeater in Northern California. And I love this chapter because it brings back so many memories for me of, you know, I had the same employer for decades, and he watched me gain and lose the same 70 pounds probably, 4 or 5 times. And, you know, he never said anything. Which was nice. He would tell me when I had lost weight. And you know, it got to the point where it would annoy me that when people would say, oh, you're losing weight, because then I always knew they knew I was gaining, but they wouldn't say anything when I was gaining, of course, which I guess is a good thing. But you know, they're thinking it and they're seeing it. But you know, this whole chapter is trying to help employers understand You know, there's a lack of knowledge that they have in relationship to this disease if they don't have it. And I think it's difficult for them to understand. When I finally did find 12-step recovery and lose my weight, then I kept it off. And I think that probably baffled people I worked with as much as, including my employer, as much as the fact that I you know, used to gain and lose it all the time. And, you know, of course, people would say, oh, you have so much great willpower. And I work in a dental office, and patients would say, oh, you know, you look great. Oh, how are you keeping it off? And so, you know, the whole frothy emotional peel, this chapter describes, you know, the normal, the moderate eater. And for people who are normal and moderate eaters, they don't understand it. And so, again, you know, like the reader mentioned, the normal drinkers are not so affected, nor they can understand the aberrations of the alcoholic. You know, the aberration is the act of departing from the right or the normal or usual course. And I was not normal or right in my head or follow the usual course of how it was to eat. You know, I had this horrible abnormal eating. And it was really amazing, because after I did lose the weight and kept it off for a long time, I remember my boss said to me one time, we had a birthday celebration at work for someone, and he said, Kathleen, you know, don't you want a piece of this cake? And I said, and you know, I always tried to tell people it's not willpower, you know, this isn't how I'm doing this. And you know, people go, oh, you can have a piece of cake now. And so that, you know, they just don't get it. They don't understand. And I said, well, you don't understand. One piece of cake wouldn't be enough for me. I'd have to eat that whole cake. And he kind of looked at me like I had two heads, but it did stop him from, you know, pushing this cake on me. And you know, and I would have people at work and, you know, patients come in and say, well, are you never going to eat flour and sugar again? Are you always going to weigh and measure your food? And to get them just to, I don't know, I think they needed hope that I wasn't always going to be weird in this other way, this other thing that I do. Okay, thank you. I will pass, I will finish up with, but I would tell them, you know, I'm just doing it for today. I may do it tomorrow, but for today I'm not. And that would appease them. Thank you, Mo. I pass.
Thank you, Kathleen. Laura A., followed by Julie H. Laura.
Hi, this is Laura A., gratefully recovered compulsive overeater in New Hampshire. And what I, thanks for letting me share. I really zoned in just now on the word fear. And when I was active in my disease, I just remember at work being just consumed by fear that I would run out of food that I had, that people could hear the wrappers and everything, because we worked in my most recent decade was in cubicles, and so people could hear everything, and God forbid anybody hear me opening a wrapper, and then I would run out, or that how could I get out of the office? I was fortunate enough that I did field work, you know, on construction sites and office work, so I was in and out all day, so timing that so that I could get my stash that I needed, and you know what? What and then I was also a manager, so I had people, you know, reporting to me, and I had some people who I'm pretty sure were isms, you know, had the ism, and I could relate from my perspective, from my, you know, own experience as to what these people might or might not be going through, and some there were times when I was able, when, you know, I got recovered and I was able to share with people about how I understood where they were coming from, and just also for me, though, also excuse me, not judging, condemning, or criticizing about it, but looking at it with compassion and seeing how we could come to some sort of a mutually beneficial way of continuing the work and moving forward with what we were tasked to do. And just by reading this just brought me back, zeroed me right back into sitting at my desk in that cubicle and trying to make less noise. And that is sort of like the illustration of my life, trying to not be seen, but screaming at the top of my lungs to be heard. And thanks for letting me share. With that, I pass.
Thank you, Laura A. Julie H., followed by Robin P. Julie.
Hi, this is Julie H., calling from New Jersey. Thank you for your service. So I'm the employee. I worked in a school for a few years, and I kept changing from classroom to classroom. I kept requesting a change. I couldn't stay in one room and work with my coworkers because I was just so uncomfortable in my own skin. I'm sorry, I was on speaker. I was restless, and then when I went to speak to my supervisor, she just changed me to another room because I always came up with a very good reason why I couldn't remain in the classroom that I was in. I always blame my coworkers, saying that they're just slacking off, they're not pulling their weight, and I'm working too hard. I blame the main teacher in the room, thinking she was lazy, or she didn't appreciate me, or she was just humiliating me. And then it came to a point where I had already changed into the third classroom, and every classroom that I left, I had a very, very good reason, a solid reason, why I explained to the supervisor why that room wasn't working. Until when I came time to leave that third room, I was so humiliated, and I was like, wait, everybody here is going to understand that I have the problem. And then I said, I better stop and realize that, hey, wait, I do have the problem. This is me. I have the addiction, and I have to blame myself, and I have to look at myself in order to recover, stop blaming my employer and my supervisor and my coworkers, and realize that I have to change my attitude and I have to change myself. And I did. I did my resentment list, and I actually called my coworkers, my supervisor, and I did amends, and then I came to a good place that I'm at now. After I did the work, it was very freeing. And blaming myself was also very freeing, you know, it was very freeing, very liberating, instead of blaming other people for what I was doing and my reactions and my addictions. And thank you very much. I pass.
Thank you, Julie H. Robin P., followed by Lynn F. Robin.
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much, Mo. I'm Robin P. I'm a grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater in Los Angeles, and a little chilly out here this morning, so my mouth is a little frozen, so sorry about that. But I wanted to just share that, you know, I think that as an employee or when I worked, you know, with different people, I was so much more challenging to work with because of the mood swings. And I think the fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. That's one of the promises. And I had so much fear of people that I wouldn't show up to social things. I would always have last minute excuses of why I couldn't show up for things that involved being with people. And when I did go, I would get so insecure that I'd end up hiding in the food a lot of times. And sometimes I could show up and not do that, but it was really Russian roulette, you know. And once I got in to the food, there was no getting out. And so that was such checked out behavior and also so self-destructive. And it wasn't anything about being of service and showing up and being of service to God and my fellows. It was the opposite of that, you know, as self-centered fear in the center of the universe, you know. And I just really get to know that it's such a blessing now that I do have the tools and the steps so that I can take responsibility for my own behavior now. And so when I need to make amends or when I need to have compassion for somebody, I get to that a lot easier than I used to just judge and be judged, you know, and is what you put out comes back. So it's such a blessing to find the compassion and find my part of things, and to be able to clean up my side of the street and have compassion for the others as I live through life, and so I can live with a clean slate every day and not feel like I'd have to cross the street if I saw anybody. So with that, I pass. Thank you. God bless everybody in your recovery.
Thank you, Robin P. Lynn S., followed by Suzanne B. Lynn.
Good morning. This is Lynn S., a recovered compulsive overeater in Toronto, Canada. I had a real, I want to say boomerang effect. That's not it, but flashback or something. Just when I read that line, it said, save the spineless and stupid. And as soon as I read that, I remembered this Muzak that used to run through my brain. You're stupid, you're fat, you're ugly. And that went on 24/7 all the time, just in the background, you know. And it, God, that's how I lived my life. And then when they go on to the next paragraph, and it talks about somebody being usually brilliant, fast thinking, and gets things done, the knack of getting things done. And I thought, God, that was my whole life at work. That list of things that had to be done, and I would get them done. And I remember one employer saying to me, you're like a workhorse. And I, oh God, it was 140 pounds overweight. So he, you know, literally, figuratively. And, you know, if you want something done, get it to Lynn. And she's like a dog with a bone, and she will get that done. But it was never in a good way. And it certainly, when the guy said to me, you're like a workhorse, you know, like, and I just, oh God, I was so humiliated. Yet I suppose they meant it in a good way, but you know, other people would get the promotions, other people would get the recognition. And when then it goes on at talking about that, you know, can you discard the feeling that you're dealing only with habit, with stubbornness and weak-willed? And I thought, these are all the things I thought about myself. You know, I'm so weak-willed and stubborn. Oh my God, I would not let go and would not change. And, you know, I'm so blessed with the fact, like, the last 30 years of my life, I was working in companies and they only knew me in a normal-sized body and that I ate differently and that's it. And you know, but before that, oh my God, you know, losing that and gaining that 100 pounds and up and down. And I'm just so relieved. And I heard it said earlier, and I know we've talked about this before, but the relief that I got when I found out finally what was wrong with me. And nobody else needs to understand it, nor can they. They either get it or they don't, especially in the rooms of OA. You either get it and you understand that you have this disease and there is recovery, or you don't. And I am so grateful that I finally got it. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you very much, Lynn S. Suzanne B., followed by Jordan L. Suzanne.
Thank you. I want to start by addressing the chapter to the employers in general, which deals with work. And in the fourth step, we're looking at security, and work is financial security. And the fourth step looks at the categories that people eat over, resentment, fear, and sex. And my financial security falls under the fear category. My spiritual malady can easily be inflated if I'm not really on top of my deep-seated fear of losing my financial security. And I didn't have good self-esteem, and I worried about losing my job, what I was going to do next, and all the other fears that go along with work. So this chapter, as others have said, is really important for both the employer and the employee. And in the first sentence, what it reminds me of is page 20, when we're given the definitions of moderate, hard, and real alcoholic. And I can use that information here when I'm taking somebody through the big book. And if they're unsure whether they are a compulsive overeater or not, here's additional information with a little different slant on understanding our condition. And then in the chapter of We Agnostics, that talks about prejudice. And we're looking at the religious and spiritual prejudice that we have. And now what we're doing here is we're looking at this information, but we're kind of recycling it to explain a societal prejudice against alcoholism. And I can't eat, drink, or think like a normal person. In my program, I was forced to admit that my thinking is really different. It's crooked. It's irrational. The way that I relate to life is really different. And when I'm thinking thoughts of others in terms of weakness, irresponsibility, those are key words that indicate that I'm bothered and I'm disconnected from my higher power. And what do? I do a 10th step, and that takes me into forgiveness. And then the chapter, or these paragraphs, have some related questions for me. Can I disregard and see things in terms of bad habits? Forget it. I was full of resentment, and I can still be resentful, but I've learned what to do. I've got to do full force fifth, sixth, and seventh steps, and then I have to be really patient and wait for my higher power to remove my shortcomings. And that patience is what I have to really ask my higher power to help me with in that seventh step. And the paragraphs also talk about the good traits that alcoholics and overeaters can exhibit. And I was unable to live to my full potential when I was in the food and in the ism of the disease. And I have to really be able to see all of that. Thanks. I pass.
Perfect. So let me, I've had my microphone up. Let me remind everybody where we are. We're on page 130, before Jordan L., that we're on page 139, the second paragraph. If you desire to help, through five paragraphs ending with the aberrations of the alcoholic. And after Jordan L., I'll take some more names. Jordan, you're on.
Good morning, Mo. Can you hear me?
I can very well. Thank you.
Okay, cool. My name is Jordan L. I am a recovered compulsive overeater in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. I got to tell you, I very much enjoy this paragraph. I mean, I'm an employer to a certain extent in that I manage people, but just this look, this perspective that this chapter takes of the alcoholic or compulsive overeater in our case, it's such an unbiased like let's look at the facts business like perspective, and I got to tell you I really like that. I really like the this approach from this place of like what is efficient, what is effective, what makes the most sense. And I suppose that's probably because of the way that my brain works, right? And I like it, too, because I had so much guilt and shame around the way that I ate for so long. Like all of these things that it's talking about, spineless and stupid and weak and stupid and irresponsible and all those things that normal people would say to me, why can't you just eat less, Jordan? Why can't you just eat less? Why can't you just eat less? And even getting to the point of, you know what, Jordan, you probably shouldn't have dessert at all. Like, they were starting to get it, you know, that I have an abnormal reaction. They could see my abnormal reaction, and they're, like, giving me this advice of, like, you know what, you probably shouldn't even touch it. Which come to find out, if I have this physical craving, it makes a lot of sense, right? So anyway, I love the perspective that this takes of like this has nothing to do with any of those things that I thought for so long it had to do with. This is simply about me having an illness and coming to an understanding of that illness, you know. And of course, as the compulsive overeater, there's a lot more I have to do after that, after I come to this understanding. But the way that this looks at that in that way, I just absolutely love. And that last line about the aberrations of the alcoholic, but there's another definition for aberration. Someone already mentioned the first one that pops up when you search it, but there's another one that's like just for optics or whatever. And it says, the failure of rays to converge at one focus because of limitations or defects in a lens or mirror. And I got to tell you, I like that one even more. I used to, when I was in the disease and my boyfriend and I used to fight all the time, I would try to tell him what it was that was going through my head. He's an alcoholic. So you'd think that he would, I'll finish up, you'd think that he would get it a little bit more than normal people. But I would tell him what was going through my head, and he would be like, Jordan, that doesn't even make sense. Like, that line of thinking is not, like, what? So that the limitation or defects of my lens when I'm in this disease and I'm not seeking a spiritual solution, you know? So anyway, very grateful to be on the line this morning. Thank you, Mo, for your service and everyone else. Yeah. I pass.
All right. Thank you, Jordan L. Appreciate the share. All right. I'm now open for more shares.
Wendy B.
Wendy B.
Kristen R., Virginia.
Kristen R.?
Yes.
Deborah G.
Barry KB.
Wait a minute. Wendy B., Kristen, I didn't get your last initial. R., then somebody else, yep. Then Sherry KB. Who was before Sherry KB?
Deborah G.
Deborah G., okay. And then someone else after Sherry? Okay, if not, we'll try those four. That probably will be perfect. Okay, I have Wendy B., Kristen R., Deborah G., and Sherry KB. Wendy B.
Yeah, hi. This is Wendy B., recovered in Arizona. And here on this line where it talks about the abnormal effect of alcohol on the brain, and I did a Google search on the abnormal action of sugar on the brain, and it was really interesting. It said that eating a diet saturated with sugar is linked to a number of abnormal brain functions, including poor memory and cognitive activities. Sugar is addictive. It takes only one bite of sugar to stimulate the brain to release dopamine, a natural chemical that also causes alcoholics and drug addicts to constantly seek a high. Sugar ages the skin. Sugar numbs our overeating sensor. And sugar reduces a factor that assists our brain with learning and forming new memories. And that just, oh my gosh, that made so much sense to me because I have just such a bad memory. Just all these things, you know, apply to me. And I just thought it was interesting to share. So thank you for letting me share.
All right. Thank you, Wendy B. Kristen R., followed by Deborah G.
Hi, this is Kristen R. in Virginia, compulsive eater and overeater. So I wanted to carry something I heard this morning from the 7 a.m. to the 10 a.m. meeting because I thought it was so valuable. So my disease is not just sugar. It is the distorted thoughts that arise around the emotions that I have. And I can't control all my emotions. I can stop, but I can do the footwork and I can put down the sugar, put down my foods that were binge foods, and I can do the steps. And when I do the steps, then I get free. So this morning I realized I love steps 1 and 2. I love saying I'm powerless. And then I love believing that there's a higher power that's going to come and rescue me. And then I get to step 3, and I've always struggled with step 3, make a decision about my will. Well, what did they mean when they said my will? What does that mean? And I would get all wrapped around the axle trying to dice it up and figure out, you know, what precisely do they want me to turn over? I mean, whoever wrote, Bill W. says specifically, turn your life over, everything. So everything. Okay, so I make the decision to turn my life over. So it's not, I don't just get to show up and say, hey, I have a disease, you know, and I've suffered from depression all my life, and so I eat. Oh, poor me, poor me. No, I don't get to do that. I take the first 3 steps, and then I do 4 through 9 to get clear. And if I don't do 4 through 9, I will spend the rest of the day wallowing in my disease. Because every morning I wake up in step 1. Every single morning I wake up and think, I can do this. I can control everything. I can control everyone. I can control my food. I've got this. And if I don't start my day with my step work, I'm lost for the rest of the day. But the beauty is once I do the footwork, once I'm in the program, once I'm practicing these principles, then I'm free. And I feel a depth of serenity that I've never felt before. Never. Years, decades of depression, gone. and I've never felt so happy and joyous and free because of this program. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Kristen R. Deborah G., followed by Sherry KB. Deborah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Deborah, compulsive overeater, and thank you so much for your lead, and thank you all for your shares, 12-step and me today, and doing a amazing miracle on my thinking. So I have that thinking all the time with me. And I really like about the stories and my experience with, and thank you so much for the read about the brain. Huge. I mean, that just right there also validates the powerlessness that I have, that my brain gets hijacked, you know, and doesn't stop. The phenomenon of craving, mental obsession, physical allergy, and keeps going, going and going. And I feel somewhat of a relief to know that all I have to do is one day at a time. All I have to do is today. You know, calling my sponsor this morning, calling in my food, my wonderful, nutritious, yummy foods, and weighing and measuring, and eating the foods that are on my food plan, and doing my daily practice of prayer and meditation. And, you know, that is so different than how I was before. That psychic change was where I was constantly looking for the sugar in the morning. And I love those experiences at doings, gatherings, where I just couldn't wait for the food. You know, I wasn't waiting for the experience of the event. I was waiting for the food. And I ate, and people would say, God, how can you eat so much? You know? And I just couldn't see it. I thought it was funny because I didn't want to see the truth. And I'm just so grateful that I'm on the phone today and listening to this, because this helps me another day to be abstinent, one day, one moment, one minute at a time. Thank you all.
Thank you, Deborah G. Sherry KB. Press star one, Sherry.
Good morning, Meg. Good morning, everybody. Sherry KB in Northern California. Grateful recovered compulsive overeater. Thank you so much for your service, Mo, and everybody on the line. You know, just listening to the shares and really appreciating the definitions, because I love definitions. And the other one about the aberrations is also abnormal actions, deviations from the proper or expected course. And, you know, that really fits who I am. I always wanted my own, my husband used to say to me, you know, there's the world's rules and Sherry's rules, and then there's, you know, the path, and then there's your path. And that's very true. And when I think about the workplace, too, how I performed, you know, when I was on a diet and I got high off doing the diet, of course, I wasn't in any program, I was a high-performance person. And then when I was face down the food, call in sick, you know, do all this kind of behavior, lower performance, you know, it was – I look back on it, you know, and I forget that, because my disease wants me to forget all the bad stuff and just think that I can do whatever. And, you know, it's just, it's amazing to me when I look back on the history, but also the judgment of myself. You know, here it is talking about people judging the alcoholic and everything, the normal eaters judging the people who, like me, have a, you know, I'm a compulsive overeater, recovered, thank God. But the judgments, and you know what? I judged myself a lot worse. I really did. Talk about, you know, being stupid or, you know, a loser or whatever, like what's wrong with me. But until I got into this work, until I really understood the doctor's opinion, and that's why it's vital for people to really understand the doctor's opinion, because if you don't, you don't understand your own disease. And how can an employer understand, you know, when they don't get it, with talking about the different types of eaters that we read about, and, you know, how important it is to understand this disease, because it's just the beginning. Putting the food down is just the beginning, because I'm dealing with all this stuff that I piled up for years and years with food that I'm really getting just to know myself. And just also that, you know, my brain was sickened, and I didn't know that. And my mind was sickened due to what the sugar did to me and the flour, too, because a lot of people don't know that flour is worse than sugar because flour actually breaks down in your system and turns into sugar, so it's harder on the body. And without the steps, without doing it this way, you know, I have a lot more compassion, not only for myself, but for people who have this disease, whereas before I didn't. If I lost weight, so can you. I had that kind of attitude, and with that, I pass. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sherry KB. And we have time for about two more shares, if two more people would like to share.
Sarah N.
Sarah N. Anyone
Cat
else?
K.
Cat K, okay. We'll take you two, and if we do about 2.5 minutes each, that would really be helpful. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. This is Sarah Ann, Gratefully Recovered in Northern California. Thank you for everyone who shared for your service, Mo, and welcome to all the newcomers on the line. I'm so grateful to listen to this chapter because I recently started a new job about a month ago, and I detested the thought of driving in traffic, and now I drive in traffic for about an hour to get to work, and I get to listen to this meeting as I go, and it's so helpful. And so it sets me off, you know, on that right foot. And so, you know, considering, like, these are the directions, like, to an employer, it makes me so nervous to think, you know, that an employer would even have this. Hopefully, prayerfully, they would be compassionate. And what I was taking away from it was that they need to read the whole book, you know, to like the goal is to get them to have some understanding or compassion for people with, you know, the illness of alcoholism or the other isms. And it just is very clear that how many people don't get it, you know, they don't understand. And I could appreciate, you know, like that normal drinker or normal eater, they don't get it. Especially I have friends that are alcoholics who don't understand the compulsive overeating, you know, even though it's the same thing. And I think this chapter, this, you know, reading could be really helpful to them as well. Just how we have a very different relationship, you know, with food. So anyway, how does it help the employer? God willing, be able to discuss it with the employer, and I have been a manager before, and I would just pray that I would have the compassion, and I do, for coworkers that, you know, I suspect might also be have the disease, just to help have compassion and the kindness and tolerance and love that, you know, I've come to understand is part of the solution to what ails us. So with that, I pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah Ann. Cat K, you'll be our last share for the day. Thank you.
Hi, Cat K, may I be heard?
Yes, you can. Oops, we lost you. You were heard there for a minute.
Sorry about that. I asked you that and pressed star one and didn't hear the answer. Realized I was unmuting. Unmuting. Cat K, compulsive overeater, recovering today. I wanted to share that this chapter is it made me think, you know, how has my eating affected my job? And at first when we started reading this, I thought, it hasn't really affected my job because I was able to hide it, and it mostly actually affected my home life as a result. And that's simply untrue, because I did think back when I was eating to just all the time I wasted obsessing about the office food they would bring in. And I just spent so much of my day at work making decisions around food that I could have been a much more productive person and got my work done and had better relationships at work had I not been in the food, even though I was still high performing. So I thought, well, you know, did it really affect me? But really the chaos, when work relationships were rough, I'd bring it back and complain to my partner. And I just was, it was just a really spiritually unfit place to be in. Today, you know, that's different. There's less excuses. I'm more productive. I'm more focused. I'm more able to be there for others. And of course, I'm imperfect human, so there's always room to improve. But at least I have a clear mind and capable to even hear, you know, that was the thing when I was in the food. I couldn't even hear feedback. I couldn't hear criticism. I was too sensitive. I was not easy to handle or manage. So be around. So anyways, I'm grateful for this program and thanks for allowing me to share.
Well, that's perfect timing. I want to thank everyone who shared and those who gave service at the meeting. Laura A., Nan K., Eileen M., and Sherry K.B. And we will now close with the reading from the Big Book on page 164, followed by the Serenity Prayer. And will Sherry K.B. please read A Vision for You?
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.